horse rider, and the more I think about this, the more it puzzles me. If the red horse rider takes peace from the earth, when has there ever been peace on the earth? If you go to, from the time of the fall, there has never been peace on the earth from the time that Adam ate the fruit. So if the red horse rider is going to come to take peace from the earth, it must be a relative peace. It must be there's something that goes on, like at the end of the Second World War, there was this brief period in the United States where there was a celebration of the victory over Japan. And then that's 1946. And in 1950, we're in Korea. I have been reading on this, and I discovered that the United States currently is involved in somewhere between 74 and 134 wars. And what has happened is that they have redefined war so that they don't necessarily call them wars. And the United States is involved since Barack Obama became president. He has increased our activities in the problems of foreign nations by 28. He's taken on 28 new projects that would be war projects. And some of it is sending special ops forces into places and so forth. And I read three different authors on this, and all three of them agreed that there were 74 wars that the United States is currently involved in, which are wars that they have acknowledged. When they get into up to the potential of 134 wars, they're getting into the areas of things they don't acknowledge, where there's secret activity going on, where the special ops forces are working. So I thought if the United States is involved in, if we just take the 74, and I go back to the counsel of George Washington. George Washington said, whatever you do, don't get involved in the affairs of foreign nations. They have their problems, let them solve their problems, deal with their problems. You stay here at home and you be independent of that. So, that has not been the case. And so right now, we kind of hear about Afghanistan and Syria and things like that, but there's a whole lot more that's happening. So I want to run through the scriptures just a little bit and take a look at this reality. I'm going to start in the fall, of course, in Genesis chapter 3. Now, there is a chronological question. The chronological question is, at what point did God create the angels? When Genesis 1:1 says, in the beginning God created the heaven and the earth, were the angels created at that point, or do the angels show up somewhere else? We do know that the angels were in existence prior to the fall of Adam, because the serpent is obviously empowered by a satanic force so that the serpent can speak to her and offer a satanic choice opposed to God's. If you will keep my commandments, you're going to have this wonderful garden, you're going to have this wonderful life, everything is going to go well, and then all of a sudden this serpent shows up. And the serpent is a talking animal, which is strange to us because there are no animals that talk. There are what there was in the garden. We don't know exactly what the serpent was, but we know that it had to have been somehow inspired by Satan to speak through him, because it is a satanic offer. And the reason we know that is because after the fall, God curses Satan. So when the serpent comes, where did the war start? Did the war start in heaven? Of course, the angel Satan attacks God. He recruits a bunch of angels to come along with him. They attack God. They are conquered. They fall. Some of them are cast into a place called Tartarus, where they still are. They're under chains of darkness. from that point on up till the point of the final judgment, when they will be brought out and then cast into the lake of fire. And all of this is in the scriptures. So in the third chapter of Genesis, when this occurs, the serpent comes, of course, and brings the challenge, and they fall. And God says in verse 15, I will put enmity between you and the woman, the serpent. He's talking to the serpent now. I will put enmity between you and the woman, and between your seed and her seed. It shall bruise your head, and you shall bruise his heel. So right off the bat, in this first book of the Bible, we encounter this war. Now, the war, I put two headings, you might say, war between man and man, and war within man. But there's also the war between, in the spiritual realm, between Satan and God, between Satan and Christ. So Satan comes to launch his war on Christ after his baptism, when he spends his 70 days in the wilderness, or 40 days in the wilderness, rather. And the serpent comes in the weakened state, or not the serpent, Satan comes in the weakened state and makes those three or four offers and says, man, if you just do this, you know, I'll give you the kingdoms of the world, turn the stones to bread, do all this sort of thing. And Jesus rebuffs him and wins the war. So right off the bat, when I read in Revelation, the sixth chapter, and I read the white horse rider comes, and I see this as education, and I can't get away from that this is education, constantly education, because education has such a broad spectrum of working. We see that. Then the red horse rider comes on the top of that and takes peace from the earth. And I say, well, wait a minute. I need to go a little deeper in here, and I need to question. When the angel came on the night of the birth of Christ, and the angels sang, peace on earth, goodwill toward men, what happened after the birth of Christ? How did peace show up? What did Herod do? Herod set out to kill all the babies, didn't he? All the baby boys. So the angels come and sing peace on earth, and this has become kind of a Christmassy thing that people sing without ever putting any thought to it, and say, well, wait a minute, there is no peace on earth. Remember the song, I heard the bells on Christmas Day, which is a Civil War song. I heard the bells on Christmas Day, their carols, you know, peace on earth, and said, there's no peace on earth. So at this point in time, he said, look, I want you to understand, this enmity that I'm going to put between you and the woman, this is not a seasonal thing. This is not something that's going to last for a little while, and then it's going to be over, and then Jesus is going to come, and that's going to terminate all this sort of thing. That's not it. It is a war between the woman, who is fallen man, and between Christ. And Satan's involved in this right up to, we get up to the end of Revelation, and we see all of this final judgment occur. This warfare is going on. So the third chapter of Genesis, we encounter this thing. And the Bible is, you could call it a book of war. What happens in Egypt? How does God make war on the Egyptians? With the plagues. And with the final plague, with the Passover, he's sending plague after plague after plague on them. And finally, the Passover, Egypt is at war with God. And Moses is simply saying, look, let God's people go. We're not here to molest you. We don't want to mess up with you guys. We don't want to cause any trouble with the way you're running your country. But we want out. We want to go to the place that's been set aside, given to Abraham. We just want to go over there and inhabit our land, which means, however, that in order to inhabit that land, they have to engage in warfare, because they have to drive the people out that are already in there. So you have this going on over and over again. And when I get up to Ezekiel, I believe Ezekiel 28, starting in that 11th verse, is really about Satan. I don't think it's about some earthly king of Tyre, and there's reasons I believe that. One of them is that the king of Tyre was never in Eden, And this character was in Eden, the Garden of God. And this character is called the anointed cherub, or the cherub that guard, the guardian cherub. That somehow this cherub, which is Satan, had a role of being like a guard in this throne room of God or whatever that we don't know anything about, that's way back there before everything happened. But in the Ezekiel 28:11, he says, "The word of the Lord came to me, saying, Son of man, take up a lamentation upon the king of Tyrus, and say unto him, Thus saith the Lord God, the first thing is you seal up the sum, full of wisdom and perfect in beauty." That's all that means is that when God created Lucifer, Lucifer was the highest ranking of all of the angels. Lucifer apparently had a higher rank than Michael or Gabriel. That Lucifer was the highest ranking because he sealed up the sum. This means that his, if we use the word gifts, talking about gifts, that he was gifted to a point beyond any other angelic being, which explains partly why he is so successful in his attack and his warfare on God and being able to consume people, because he knows how to do it. He is very wise and very cunning. So he said, "You seal up the sum perfect in wisdom, full of wisdom, perfect in beauty. You have been in Eden, the garden of God. Every precious stone was your covering, the sardius, the topaz, the diamond, the beryl, the onyx, the jasper, the sapphire, and so forth. And he said, the workmanship of your tabrets and of your pipes was prepared in thee the day you were created." That means musical skill. How come we have so much music? How come we have so many different kinds of music? How come there is so much music that is not music which glorifies God? How come there is so much music which is actually a debauched form of music that takes people into drugs? Bob was at the park again last night. Is he home yet? Okay, so, and the bands that they schedule in out there, all these bands that come in are bands which promote drug use. And their music is loud and wild, and Bob spends his nights, Friday night, Saturday night, and I don't think he goes on Sunday night, does he? Just Friday and Saturday he goes to the park, and they spend the night under the people taking the drugs, and they're hauling them down to the medical tent, and they're doing whatever they can do, and they're trying to rectify this, but they keep bringing in the musicians which promote it. And the reason is they get such crowds with these people. So if they were to do a complete switch and say, you know what, this summer we're going to change up, we're going to do nothing but gospel, we're going to have gospel groups coming in here or whatever, their crowds would probably fall down enormously, and that means the drug trafficking would fall down, but it means they wouldn't get so much money. So this character creates music, and people buy it. They celebrate it, all right? Then he said in verse 14, "You are the anointed cherub that covers, and I have set you so." The reason you had your office, you were in such a high office, is because I put you there. And he said, "You were upon the holy mountain of God. You walked up and down in the midst of stones of fire," which has something to do with judgment. I don't completely understand all of it, but he had something to do with judgment. And then he says, "You were perfect in your ways from the day you were created till iniquity was found in you." So this character, Lucifer, who gets his name changed to Satan, which means an adversary, has been an adversary now ever since, at some point, as I said, if you go chronologically, I don't know exactly where that fits. But I know that he shows up in Eden, and he comes to molest Adam and Eve to the point of bringing them to the fall. And then what does he do right after that? It isn't just a short time that he induces Cain to kill his brother. So this warfare is going on and going on and going on. And you say, well, wait a minute, though. Red Horse Rider comes to take peace from the earth. So it can't be a perfect peace, all right? Now, so on these little bits here, we have this historical thing that's going on in the scriptures. What about the warfare, the spiritual warfare between the Roman Catholic Church and the true church of Jesus Christ. You live in a time where that's not, because you live in the United States, you don't know about that. That is, we don't even know that that's still going on. That down in South America, wherever the Roman Catholic Church becomes predominant, once they become predominant, then they begin to exercise this this Inquisition. And they begin to do things that has to do with the murdering of people. I think about those folks where Greg was going every year. These people that are coming into the Reformed faith, and they meet and they have church, and Greg was going down and ministering to them. And who was the other guy that was going? Yeah, Bill was going down. So I think, well, I've often wondered how they stand in the province they are, wherever they are, what the Roman Catholic position is there, because if it's very strong, they're going to have some difficulty coming back upon them. So that's not known here, because the churches seem to be functioning, you know, like they're doing, and the Roman Catholic Church is over there doing their thing. Except they get into this ecumenical thing, then they begin to blend. So the warfare, the spiritual warfare that's been going on, and I thought, let me give you one piece of history, because I talked to you about the Trent, about what went on at Trent. All of the anathemas that came out of there are still intact. Those have never been removed. And that means that if you do not acknowledge the Pope to be basically God on earth, the Pope claims to himself the right to change any laws God has given. So he can actually take the Ten Commandments and he can do anything he wants with them. And when you get into the Jesuit order, the Jesuits do that all the time, because they use a thing that's called the redirection of the intention. And all they have to do is to, like Bill Clinton did with the women he was molesting, he would give some kind of or he was doing something for their good or whatever, just change the direction of intention, so that it's no longer, in their mind anyway, it's no longer a sinful thing. They're doing something that's all right. They also use a thing called the end justifies the means. If the end justifies the means, they can do anything they want to do, so that when it's over, they have either built up the Roman Catholic Church, or they've elevated the Pope, or they've elevated the Black Pope, who is the head of the Jesuit order, whatever. And this Pope happens to be a Jesuit, which means that you've got a double problem right there. So none of these things have been known in the United States. Even though the Jesuits have done a lot of dirty work, they never get blamed for it. So we don't know that. But back in 1526, King Charles, you know, the Reformation is moving. Luther has been on trial at the Diet of Worms. He's taken his stand. They weren't able to kill him. He's gone up to Wartburg Castle. He's in Wartburg Castle. He's producing the Bible, the German Bible. He's at liberty. He has to stay in the castle pretty much, but he's at liberty to do. And the cardinals and so forth over here are infuriated, because they want this man dead. And so in 1526, the King Charles rendered a decision in which he said that in the various provinces or towns or cities or however countries, they had freedom of religion. So the reformers were now allowed to practice their Reformed faith, and nothing could be done to them. They were at complete liberty to do it. That was in 1526. 3 years later, because of the movement of the Pope against him and threats to excommunicate him and all that sort of thing, he calls that is called the Edict of Spires. He calls the Diet of Spires in 1529, and these people come in and they told him, we're only going to be here about an hour, because our only reason here is to undo the edict. So we're going to have to make a ruling up here that says, this is the way they were going to do it. You guys that are already, you know, what they call grandfathered, you guys that are already here, you're under the blessing or whatever. You can practice your Reformed faith. But no more people will be allowed to do that. And so the princes raised up against that, and they said, no, we protest that. And that's where the word Protestant came from. But this was a part of this ongoing war between what came to be known as the Protestants, that's actually the Reformers, came to be as this war between Rome and this new movement on the earth that God brought about, which was a revival. The Reformation was a true reform. And it happened, it didn't just happen in a town, it happened in nations. It began to spread so that people were leaving the Roman Catholic Church right and left, and they were going on about the solas. They were beginning to teach. They were beginning, the preachers were doing this. Wow, we got a problem, says Rome. So they come back and they put this new, they repeal the edict, and now they got a war going on. What is a Protestant? The Protestant, definition of Protestant. Any of a group of German princes and cities presenting a defense of freedom of conscience. Freedom of conscience against an edict of the Diet of Spires in 1529 intended to suppress the Lutheran movement. A member of any of several church denominations denying the universal authority of the Pope and affirming the Reformation principles of justification by faith alone, etc. So the solas, we'll say that, this justification by faith alone and the five solas. So in this dictionary, they have the definition correct. What is a Protestant? Well, today in America, you don't really have Protestants. The difference between the Roman Catholic Church and the other churches is not that clear cut, and you don't have this protest going on that Rome can't influence. They can't bring their rules in and begin to put their rules on other denominations with regard to their practice. But the Methodists have caved in many. Look what's happened to the Lutheran Church. The Lutheran Church has re-upped with Rome almost. And when we went down, Martha and I went down to Canfield to Lou Ann's dad's funeral. I think it was her dad. Went down to the funeral, walked into that Lutheran church. I couldn't believe what I was seeing. These crucifixes all over the place. And it was like walking into a Roman Catholic church. And as I sat there, I began to remember, you know, I just read a couple articles about this happening, but didn't realize to what extent it had gone on. And I saw a sign in front of St. William's that said, Catholics coming home. Catholics coming, I thought, what do they mean, Catholics coming home? Did people quit coming to church and now they're coming? No, they're talking about the denominations returning back under, to some degree, the headship of the Pope and beginning to accept what was Roman Catholic doctrine in various ways. And they're beginning to honor the Pope as being somehow the head of the churches, because he believes he's the head of every single church in the world. He's the head of it. And he can dictate to every church, and he can dictate to every government. That's what he actually believes, because he believes he is God on earth, and that's why they call him Holy Father, among other things, all right? Well, this warfare that's going on, that this Red Horse Rider obviously has been doing for a long time, but yet John sees him coming out toward the end in a different way. So I say, all I can say is it has to have been some form of a relative peace. We have known in the United States, it's too bad that you guys couldn't have lived when I lived as a child, so that you could see the clear distinction between what it was like in 19... I was born in 34. My first recollections of behavior, activity, and so forth are probably from somewhere around 38. Probably 4 years old. And at the age of five, my brother took me to a movie for the first time. He took me down to the Robbins Theater and we saw a movie called The Man in the Iron Mask. And I was terrified. I sat in there in that movie and I was frightened to death of what was going on, and he was just enjoying it. And that thing, I've seen it on television. So, but we used to travel around on foot never, anytime, never, ever having a fear that by doing so, we were putting our lives at risk. There never was a concern of somebody mugging you, you know, kidnapping you, whatever it might be. None of that stuff existed to the extent that it exists now. And the reason that was true is because in the 30s and then up into the 40s, we still had a Christian morality in our country. We still had, using the word Protestant, we still had a Protestant morality. And the Bible was still center, so that Bibles were everywhere. I mean, I had teachers in grade school at Francis Willard that used the Bible. Miss Bishop, who was our music teacher, she used the Bible all the time, and she taught us hymns. In our singing, we sang hymns, and there I was. I didn't know from nothing. I'd never been to church in my life. I didn't know anything about this, and I'm going up through my first 6 years of schooling, and we're singing the hymns. And when we had our programs, we sang hymns and patriotic songs. That was Miss Bishop. So there still was, in Hollywood at that time, they had a list of rules, what they could show in a movie. The morality of Hollywood was controlled by, I don't remember what they called it, but controlled by some group of people who had to see every movie that was made, had to go before this board, and the board had to approve it to be shown in the theaters to make sure that it had a sound biblical morality. And that's one of the reasons why even in married couples in those old movies, they were always in twin beds. They never were together. The interaction between them was always limited. They would kiss, but there would be nothing except Roy. Roy never kissed anybody but Trigger. And he refused to do that. He said, no way. They tried to get him to, before he and Dale, when he first started working with Dale, and prior, to kiss his leading lady in the movie. He refused to do it. He said, I'm going to kiss my wife. So that was a standard. What we call society, the social order, still had a very strong biblical morality about it. The Ten Commandments. Nobody was afraid to have Ten Commandments on the wall. They weren't afraid to have people praying before, when they'd have a parent-teacher meeting. They would have somebody pray before the meeting. That was order of the day. And then it began to change in the 50s. You began to see this thing begin to sway around. Book of John, 8th chapter of the Gospel of John. Jesus is talking here. There's a couple other places, but I'm going to start down in verse 31. Now we have great contrast going through this, all right? And we have cause and effect in here. Then Jesus said to those Jews which believed on him, if you continue in my word, then are you my disciples indeed, and you shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free. All right? So first of all, we have the cause, continuing in the word. So if we continue in the word, it's only then that we are truly disciples. If we do not continue in the word, that's why we can't cave to Rome, because we can't get into traditions and things of that nature. We have to continue in the word if we are to be counted by God as disciples indeed. And the result of that continuation is you shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free. I'm going to put a little rabbit trail here. Let me tell you one of the problems that Donald Trump has. The educational movement and now the religious movement for many years now have been teaching lies to people. And they have been converting them to become secular humanists. And in the Humanist Manifesto, you have to read it. You have to study the first and second manifestos to get to what I'm talking about. But they have been successfully now, once they finally got that into the school system, and I thank God I got through before it happened, although it was beginning then, all right, that these people that have been, since the 50s at least, up until now, have all been educated to be secular humanists. And they don't even know it. So their moral view has changed. What is morally correct? What is morally incorrect? Now this has been so strongly impressed upon them that it's got into the area of achievement. That achievement now, if you are going to set out to achieve, you are accused of being, almost a criminal. So that if Donald Trump has billions of dollars, that automatically makes him a criminal of some sort because of the current philosophies that are being promoted that you're supposed to remain poor or whatever it might be. And if you have all this money, you're automatically a bad guy. Politically, the Democratic and Republican parties, the Democratic Party was taken over by the Communist Party back about 1913, and that's the reason you got the Federal Reserve System, and that's the reason you got income tax, and that's the reason you got direct election of senators, because that took it out of the hands of the people, and that put it into this system where the Communist Party had moved in and actually infiltrated and began to get more and more control. Then over time, they got across the aisle and got the Republicans too. So politically, now the idea is that for a person to run for office, they had to espouse to a philosophy that was an anti-biblical philosophy. So you couldn't run for office where if you were a Puritan or a separatist in 1620 running for office in America, if you did not espouse biblical truth, you didn't have a prayer of getting elected to an office. You had to be knowledgeable of the law of God. Up through till about the mid-1800s, you had to have a degree in theology before you could have a degree in law. You could not practice law until they were sure you knew the law of God. Now we switched that over to where you cannot have a biblical worldview, because if you have a biblical worldview, you're going to have to stand against about every system that is currently in operation in not only the United States, but in the world. And to stand against that is going to make you highly unpopular because the people believe the lie. God gave them over to strong delusion to believe the lie. And once the people begin to believe the lie, I said this to you before, once they begin to believe it, you can't speak against it. Because now they're convinced that if you're speaking against what they've come to believe, you are, so there's something wrong with you. So one of the problems Donald Trump has is that whether he's doing it correctly or incorrectly is immaterial to me, and what God is going to accomplish through him, I don't know. But he has this problem. If he's going to stand up and identify Hillary, for instance, as being what he calls a crook, which she is, if he's going to identify the news media that he called them dishonest, which is true, if he is going to speak truth to these people, the truth he's speaking is going to get a horrible reaction, because not only do the people who are he's speaking to, not only they are under a delusion, but the rest of the people are under the same delusion, and they now see this man. This man is an oddity. He isn't like George Bush. He isn't like the brother. He isn't like John McCain. He isn't like, this guy is standing up and he is speaking things out that need to be spoken, but the people that are hearing, you've got, of course, a huge following, but the rest of the people, the media and so forth, that's like foreign language to us, because their world is being called into question, and their quest of power, being able to have this absolute power to be able to control your lives in every way they want to control it, how much money you can make, where you can live, and all this sort of thing. If that is broken, their power is broken. They're not going to yield that. This is Satan. Satan does not want to yield power. He knows eventually he's going to hell. But while he is free, he is moving to do something other than let people know the truth. And you can't have true freedom without knowing the truth. So they shall know the truth. You shall know the truth. And the truth shall make you free. And they said, wait a minute. This is this crowd that's answering Donald Trump. They say, wait a minute. We were Abraham's seed. We were never in bondage to any man. How do you say we shall be made free? We've never been in bondage. I guess they don't know about Egypt. They don't know about Babylon. They don't know about Assyria. They don't know about Greece. They don't know about anything. We have never been in bondage to any man. That's not true. And Jesus says, verily I say unto you, whosoever committeth sin is the servant of sin. Now that's a whole different concept. They're thinking about political freedom. He's thinking about freedom in a different way. Whoever commits sin is the servant of sin, and the servant abideth not in the house forever, but the son abideth forever. If therefore the son shall make you free, you shall be free indeed. I know that you're Abraham's seed, but you seek to kill me. Why? Okay, think about this Trump situation. You seek to kill me because my word has no place in you. My word has no, look, Jesus said, look, if you have seen me, you have seen the Father. My Father and I are just alike. I am the Son of the Most High God. I am the Messiah. I am here to redeem you. All of those things you did in the temple and in the tabernacle and all those festivals and feasts, all of those spoke about me. Passover you celebrate, that spoke about me. I am the Passover lamb. And here I am talking to you, and you people seek to kill me. Why? Because my word has no place in you. I speak that which I have seen with my Father, and you do that which you have seen with your Father. And, of course, he tells them in the 10th chapter that their father is the devil. I speak that which I have seen with my Father, and you do. There's a difference between the speaking and the doing between the fathers. This is a great, great warfare that's going on. And then he says in verse 40, but now you seek to kill me, a man that has told you the truth. Now, I thought, as I have pondered Donald Trump's plight, as I have pondered, I can't help but think of, here is a guy named, that in the denomination they call Jim Jr. And Jim Jr. has this awful, 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 weighty obligation to stand up here in this pulpit and tell people the truth. And sometimes in the telling of the truth, that's the worst thing you can do for some people. And this is what Christ is experiencing. I have told you the truth. This is the plight of preachers through the ages, the prophets in the Old Testament, the apostles, the disciples, the guys up through the years, standing there to tell the truth. That's what Martin Luther had to deal with. Look, guys, I'm trying to tell you the truth. I can't accept your pope, and I can't accept you cardinals. I have to accept the word of God. You got to convince me from the scripture that I'm wrong, and you can't. John Wycliffe is walking around. He's in trouble because he's walking around expounding the word. John Huss, a whole bunch more. This is what's happening. Coming up through, we have these fellows. When we just talked about this yesterday. What's the guy's name? Preach sinners in the hands of an angry God. And he's, this is the plight of the preacher. The preacher has to tell the truth. Why? Because the truth sets people free. Well, what if you're telling them the truth and they don't want to receive the truth? Then what you're going to get is a reaction. And it's a warfare. It is a powerful warfare that is going on, and this is what we have to deal with. So here he says, look, you guys say you're Abraham's seed, but still you want to kill me. And this one, you know this very, you're very familiar with the 10th chapter of John. And Jesus says concerning this thief, this satanic being, the thief comes not but for. There's only one mission that Satan has. The thief comes not but for to steal, to kill, and to destroy. Now, in contrast, I am come that they might have life, and they might have it more abundantly. So in the speaking of the truth, if you have the truth, you have freedom. You have abundant life. Jesus said, I've come to give you abundant life. So as people receive truth, the biblical truth, that's the only place we can get it. We get this truth. There are other truths with regard to electricity and things of that nature. That's not the issue. We're talking here about the spiritual life. And the truth comes from the Word of God, and you can't get anywhere else. And so here's the preacher who has this obligation. I have to tell you the truth, guys. All right? So when in the morning when the kids come in, and they come to school, and they're here about 8.5 seconds, and there's still all, two of them already in a fight. And somebody comes in, and so I sit down with them, and I say, you can't, what you're doing is sin. you can't do this. This is sinful. You cannot exalt yourself to the point that nobody can, because sometimes the fight because somebody, the way somebody looked at me, that's about dumb, but that's what happens. So you have to tell them the truth. What you're doing is sin. This goes completely against what God's word says. Jim's preaching the 13th chapter of 1 Corinthians, and he's trying to get people to learn this lesson of love, 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 what it's all about. Remember when you guys sang at the Brethren Church, love, 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 gospel and the word is love, and there were people sitting on their own. Faces crinkled. Wait a minute, they're singing to you about love, all right? So the warfare, when we read the Red Horse Rider, and I've got more to get into with regard to the warfare, but the Red Horse Rider says the White Horse Rider comes conquering and the Red Horse Rider comes to take peace from the earth. And I say, man, peace has been taken from the earth. As I said, this whoever the one guy was that I read about the history of the United States, he said there's been 22 days since the Treaty of Paris was signed. 22 days of peace in the United States since that time. He's taking into account all the Indian wars, inner city wars, I mean, you name it. There's wars of all different kinds where there hasn't been really a peace in the nation. Wars with Mexico, wars down in South American countries, right, all over. I never thought about that. 22 days of peace. So that's somebody that took the time to do the research. I have to quit.